Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with another episode of WeWork Radio, and I got a full house here, and I'm excited to learn about all of the guests. And we're going to kick it off with Tim Visconti, and he is with PeopleLift. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you for having me here.
Tell us about PeopleLift. How are you serving folks?
Sure. So this idea originated over 8 years and 9 startups that I've helped scale from various capacities. And the idea being there's a better, more effective way to impact your talent from the first interaction till your last day. So looking at this as a complete data transformation on how we approach the talent analytics space. And then providing that to the small business world, typically that's been housed in big four consulting agencies, 500, 600 an hour that completely prices out 80% of the marketplace. So bringing those strategies down to the SMB level purely to fuel startups. That's what we're here to do.
So startups are your target?
Startup target market. Our customer profile is weird because we've got customers in 3 different countries, 4 different time zones, ranging up to $1.5 billion in revenue. But our sweet spot is those SMBs that are looking to, try to change their marketplace, but don't have necessarily the tools, access, or technically the background to be able to help get it off the ground from a people perspective.
Now, why the name PeopleLift? What's the thinking behind that?
Sure thing. So one of my favorite kind of memes that I've seen on there is that if you find success, the idea is to send the elevator back down. And I've had people throughout my entire life that have brought me along and helped mentor me or coach or provided opportunities that candidly aren't available to a lot of folks. So the idea is that our entire organization is built to lift people, businesses, to find profitability, but then and change the world in a positive way.
Now, the companies you typically deal with, are you dealing with the founders and they're about to hire new people, or are you fixing existing people?
Currently, both. The target market would be early stage founders that are trying to take an idea and turn it into an action. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult space from a lot of funding perspective because, hey, I'm in a startup as well and, cash is king. But if you look at it from what our broader impact will be when we bring on additional partners as we scale this year is to be able to service enterprise clients as well in that digital transformation space.
Now, when you're working with these small companies, they can't afford mistakes.
Exactly.
Right? The margin of error is thin. Mm-hmm. So how do you kind of help them attract and retain the A talent?
Absolutely. So first and foremost, knowing that this is a difficult space to work in and coming at this from the full kind of transparent look of saying, we as a business have failed before. We have made mistakes. This is part of the learning process. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the people that you bring on board, this is an area you cannot screw up. Bad investments, bad ideas. Right? I hate the word bad in a lot of ways because you learn something new, kind of the right. Ben Franklin mentality here of figuring out 200 ways a light bulb's not going to work. But at the same time, when it comes down to the methodical approach to talent, it starts off with an IO psychology background, really built in on competency-based interviews, and then focusing on wins and alignment of creating your SEAL team, if you will. Instead of just you have a skill and you have an experience, we're pioneering the whole, are you the right person that fits in with this within this ecosystem, especially with the amount of resources that are available in on-demand types of ways with Upwork and all these kind of remote-based functions. You have a larger supply to pull from, but that could become daunting to an SMB or to a startup. So the idea is a full evaluation of who you are as a founder, as an owner, and what pieces would align best with you to demonstrate your success long term.
Now, do you help them if they want to use an outsource service like that?
No, absolutely. Yeah, the whole idea is that we're a marketplace to it. So if you bring a question that touches talent any which way, whether it be systems, process, or the actual people, we have either a direct connection and service that we can provide for you or an ecosystem of people that have been doing this for decades. So the answer is not always we will solve it for you, but we can point you in the right direction with a warm handshake to be able to help you solve those problems as they come up.
Because sometimes the answer is to choose an outsourced contract laborer.
Absolutely.
As opposed to a member of the team.
And I think that the market is moving more towards that. We see that every single day. When you get into this gig on-demand based economy, you start to see a transformation internally from a workforce perspective. You're seeing that the way the millennials have changed the way. We're going to talk about housing here in a little bit. There's a lot of these kind of cornerstones of what American capitalism has been built on that are going to be changing. What used to be the gold watch and the 50-year standard, now if we get 6 to 8 months, that's considered a win.
Right.
And that type of turnover creates significant risk for a startup. So the idea being, if you put in a methodical approach on the front end and then build in a true talent program throughout your life cycle, building that muscle memory in from day one, you'll have a greater chance of success in the long term.
So if I contract with PeopleLift, I can hire you to fill that slot, and then you're just cycling people through that slot, and I just train you once, and I don't have to train this new person every 6 months?
In a lot of ways, yes. And it's built to be kind of Netflix-y in a way, because it can be widget on demand. So the theory is that you don't need a people officer if you're less than 10 people every single day of the week. Let's mm-hmm. just be very direct here. But if you're able to break that into an hourly basis and have problem or solution-based allocations for those widgets, then you're able to scale your organization more effectively, but at the same time, keeping your total P&L down, because let's be upfront, employees are very expensive and right. from a base of benefits and everything that goes into it. So we're playing to that gig-based economy and saying, we're not going to ask you to bring us on full-time, but we'll provide a 2-3x on that service allocation, because the theory behind everything we're doing is a techno-human solution. Like where talent and HR departments have been typically one person doing 5 or 10 different functions, we've now been able to allocate that down into 2 to 3 key areas, and with tech doing the hard labor for us.
Okay, so walk me through an onboarding. Like, say somebody, what's the pain the person has? Like, I'm growing and I don't have the right personnel. Like, there's some pain
sure.
like that
sure.
usually.
The two common themes that we've had with every client, and there's a variety of pain points. I mean, from systems, process, generating revenue, whatever that may be that we mm-hmm. can bring into
like,
it.
You would help if I need a new sales. We've never had a salesperson. The
exactly.
founder is always the salesperson.
We're actually doing that right now with a startup local here in Atlanta, is building out what a chief revenue officer duty responsibilities mm-hmm. and scope would be to help them craft who they're going to go after. Because the idea being, oh, we have a pain point, we need sales. So the first thing you do is you try to hire a salesperson without thinking what's the next 3 dominoes after that
right.
and what's actually going to be best for your business. Because, you know, pain creates opportunity for a lot of businesses. We look at that as a way of a time to slow down and pause and be able to say, how do we best do this for the next 18, 24 months to best use your cash.
And not just put a Band-Aid over what
exactly.
you think is the problem.
Yeah, when the Band-Aids, let's just be upfront, there's an $11 billion staffing industry that is built to solve Band-Aid problems.
Right.
I believe we're in this awakening period and saying, why are we spending this much money to just, you know, fill a hole versus actually looking at this as a true trajectory from an internal perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't get that access until you've gone through enough pain to where you say, oh, I've burned, you know, a couple $100,000 in cash. This was a mistake. The idea is to get well ahead of that with
right.
this organization.
Okay, so let's get back to that example. Go ahead.
Oh, so from the CRO. So talk about the two pain points. So the number one and two, we can't hire the right people because the market is insanely competitive right now. The average engineer, if they pop on the marketplace, has an offer within 7 business days. That is from day one, they raise their hand to an offer in hand. So if you're not active and ever present in that marketplace, you will lose out. But then the second bit is the best people tend to leave very quickly in organizations, especially in startups.
Uh-huh.
So
then you address that.
Absolutely. So we build in true career tracks from day one, map out roles and responsibilities, and essentially set up a workflow based off of if, then, and budget to be able to help you scale your team effectively no matter what industry you're in.
And then do you specialize in certain industries?
E-commerce is the area that we've been the most successful and have the most experience, but I've been in auto, retail, telecom, government-based. It's really touched.
It doesn't matter. You're kind of industry agnostic.
And that's the point, because in skill sets are industry specific, but the strategy behind how to empower people does not have to
right,
be tied to an industry.
Right, that doesn't. What about professional services?
So in a lot of ways, people like to put us in that professional services bucket because they view us as a one-time type of transaction. But the idea is, if you kind of like Netflix, if you have a low barrier to entry and you're able to have access to great content and great solutions, that you should be able to stick with us long term. And that's what we're the end all goal be. But, you know, typically we're about about 6 to 9 months on a client site, and then we do a transition work and bring in an employee that takes over the responsibilities in that gap that we created.
And you mentioned small to mid-size, but there's also an enterprise play on this as well.
Absolutely. So we've got some wonderful partners that have, or wonderful future partners that are all looking to saying, how do we shape the world of talent for tomorrow? We've got some great people lined up that have done enterprise change management for, you know, 15, 20 years. We've got some great TEDx level speakers that are going to be joining our organization. So we're on a crazy trajectory considering we've only been open about 7 months. So we'll have, I think, 7 to 8 total full-time employees by the time Q1 ends, and then we'll be servicing three different continents. So
and then,
off we go.
But you're going to get the word out through kind of this thought leadership and speaking.
Yeah.
And so you're attacking conferences and those.
Absolutely. So right now we're in that wonderful problem of we've committed to so much work that it's actually pulled back from my ability to get out to the marketplace.
Right.
This has
so
been a wonderful
you're having the
venture.
Same the challenges of your customers.
Yeah, no, and that's what there's a mutual shared pain here.
Right.
So like I'm building this and I'm suffering with you. So here's how I'm approaching it. This is what I've seen work. And I think what's actually more important is I've seen it not work. And we've had great ideas, but when you have poor execution, doesn't matter how much money or cash you throw at a situation, if you're not proper planning, then you are going to fail.
Now, you mentioned you were part of other startups. What is this first time as CEO?
This is my first time as CEO, but I've acted as a kind of chief people officer for these for the startups. So it started off as more of a consultant, then it ended up becoming clear that they needed a people leader function within that. And then it just naturally became the business. This was not just a lightning idea, if you will. This was built over 10 years of figuring out what not to do.
In the weeds for other people.
Exactly. And it's a lot of fun. This is the best group to work with because entrepreneurs share that spirit, have that vivacious nature to
and
them.
And they want to solve problems.
Exactly.
Right.
And it would, problem solving is begins and ends with me. Like you'll see me get jacked up over this just primarily because I like hard things. If this was simple, I would not be focusing my energy and effort into it.
So now, as part of your team, how did you go about that initial hiring? Was it just people you knew?
410 resumes, 55 interviews.
So you didn't start in your own network?
I actually ended up hiring someone that I hired previously. So it's one of those absolutely pain points, especially with your first employee. Like that is the hardest one to hire because you have so many things you need them to do. So I kind of rebranded it as my right arm. So I'll be left arm, you be right arm, and we just take care of each other. But it is absolutely painful and critical that you go through that. But a business owner typically doesn't have the 70 to 80 hours of just pure interviewing to go through. And that's what we're trying to augment. But I suffer through the same thing. My critical standards, I find it funny to my clients, they say this. They're like, well, shouldn't it be easier for you? Because
it's
this is what
harder.
You do.
You're pickier.
Exactly. I think it's the complete opposite. My standards are so high at this point that I think it's unrealistic. So I actually feel bad for the first folks that are coming on board here. So shout out to Chantria for hanging with us.
So now, walk me through that first hire for you. How did you go about any tips for somebody that's going through the same thing?
Sure thing. So I believe in like direct marketing and kind of playing an ecosystem. So a lot of folks will just go to a job board, post a job, and it's what we call post and pray. And I don't think you really want to go down that strategy. So I actually do direct ad buys within Facebook. I do Twitter, Instagram. So to go out to a specific persona that we've targeted. So bringing in a more of a marketing level element to it just to get the word out. The second bit is to have clear understanding of what their deliverables are going to be. Not just I need someone to solve a problem, but what are they going to do when they solve that problem? What are the next two dominoes after that?
So they have to be a proactive personality, not somebody that just goes down a checklist.
Yeah. I find it funny that skills and experience are still super relevant today in the world where every 6 months we're having to skill up or retrain our brains, especially if in the engineering field. It's like, people that started off, 10 years ago using certain skill sets are not using those anymore.
Right.
So why are we holding people to skills and experience that are not going to be relevant in 6 months? So I focus primarily on the person. And that comes from more of a psychology background with a ton of focus on how you handle, one, stress behavior, how do you react when things go wrong? And second bit, can I trust you? It sounds very basic, but that is such a hard thing to kind of build in through a very short interview process. So with the way that we've gone about
it. So what's your trust test? You leave like a $20 bill on the floor?
here's a cute dog. Here's a leash. Don't walk away type of a deal. No. So there's we do it in kind of three different ways. Is that first and foremost, we establish a commitment from the first conversation. Is that if I uphold my end of the bargain and put you through this rigorous assessment, that we're going to over communicate at each challenge step. So I really get them to push back on me in the interview process, which is backwards because a lot of people will look at it and say, you're trying to say all the right things to get the job. I'm actually challenging you to challenge me in the very first conversation.
And then, so if you're not getting that initially, that's kind of a red flag right there.
It is to me because
is that a deal breaker?
I hire free thinkers and I openly invite creative conflict. Mm-hmm. If this is not the best avenue to go down, tell me why. Right. Don't just say it's not working, but present a solution. And I try to find that solution side on the very first conversation. Second bit is a working session. So we'll do some form of a challenge. So for what we do, there's a lot of high volume resume flip through, social media outreach. So I'll give them a certain set of parameters and say, if you are a business owner, how would you go about this? Walk me through your process. Mm-hmm. And then I actually see them engage with our brand. So I give them a temporary access to be able to control that just to see how they operate in that space.
Even though they don't necessarily know your way yet.
Exactly.
You want to see what their way looks like.
I want to understand how you approach a problem. Mm-hmm. Because if I understand how you approach a problem, we can then find a better solution together.
Right.
Because if I'm just telling you what to do all day, then that is counteractive and to what I need.
That's not what you need. You don't need another you.
No. And as my wife would say, I don't think we need another one of me anyway. So it's interesting if you really put trust and faith in candidates to do the right thing, most people will. It's a really kind of weird trust other side of the desk mentality I'm trying to break. You know, we're just people. We're trying to get through. But then the third bit is really just a in-depth, wide-range interview. So I actually had fellow entrepreneurs, my mentor, and even folks of my family have a conversation with them. I need as many different viewpoints as humanly possible to bring.
Because you want to be challenged. You
exactly.
want people, you want them to question why you're picking this person.
Exactly. And if I can't defend that, then I don't need to be able to hire this person.
Right. So what do you need more of right now?
Right now? Time. If you can give me two more hours back
more
in the day,
hours.
I think I would be good. The 26-hour day would be wonderful. No, I mean, I think what I'm experiencing the best kind of pain that a startup feels is we've committed to clients, we are delivering to our clients, and now how do we build while trying to scale our own team? Mm-hmm. So drive revenue and make sure we hire to the same standards that we're doing, which there's no easy way of doing this. It is through brute effort and extra hours and weekend. Most of the time I end up interviewing folks on Saturdays and Sundays anyway, just because of the nature of the work we have right now.
So now why WeWork?
So WeWork was a natural plug-in. It is a celebration of entrepreneurial spirit. It allows open access to different ideas, opportunities, and networking events. But most importantly, it's just a bunch of folks that are ideologically driven similar to me. Like mm-hmm. we want to change the world. So I want to be in that ecosystem because you are the sum of your parts, not just who you are as a person.
So if somebody wanted to learn more and have more substantive conversation, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Sure. www.peoplelift.co.co, not com on this one. And then you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at lift_people, LIFT_PEOPLE.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
All right. Hang with us. We've got a couple more guests. Next up on WeWork Radio, I got Christine Alcaciba, and she is, are you the info tycoon?
I am. It's just me.
Info tycoon. So tell us about Info Tycoon. How are you serving folks?
Yeah. So first of all, thanks for having me. Info Tycoon, we essentially make software that serves the multifamily industry. So for most people, that's a non-term, but the multifamily industry is essentially an ecosystem of management companies, of individual owners and buyers who manage large portfolios of properties, both nationally and internationally. So think of Post or Amley or some such.
So is it only apartments or it could be condos?
It could be condos. We're also serving student housing, for instance.
Dorms.
Yep, you mm-hmm. got it. And then expanding to think about senior living, military living situations. So and at some point, managing any kind of space, right? Because the software we have, the way that we're building it at this point, should be able to expand into a place like WeWork, where you're managing individuals, you know, offices or individual
right. So because there shouldn't be any difference between an apartment or an office,
right?
In a
right.
like co-working space.
Theoretically, there shouldn't be,
but there is.
Building it is quite
a little
different,
trickier.
But yeah.
Mm-hmm. So now, how'd you get into this?
Yeah. How did I get into this? I actually was a librarian in a previous life.
That's
at Emory.
Logical career path.
Yeah. I worked in a special collections library and did that for almost 10 years and then decided that, well, so many of the things that we were collecting were digital in nature, and that's the future of special collections. Mm-hmm. So my projects became UX projects without knowing that they were UX projects. And so I decided, you know, 4 years ago to make that pivot into UX, and with my background and my master's degree, becoming a UX researcher and engineer was a really natural fit. And so I joined Info Tycoon about 9 months ago doing exactly that.
And so that's what you're doing for them?
Yes.
And then how's it going?
You know, it's a really fun job. I think of myself as being kind of the interpreter between the boots on the ground and the developers, right? So
You're the translator.
I am the translator. I'm the one who gets to go out into the trenches, talk to our clients, live a day in their shoes, go do an inspection of a 200 unit property, come back, and then tell my developers like how our product is actually performing on the ground, mm-hmm. and how we can improve it using certain design solutions. So it's been a lot of fun.
So walk me through what it's like. Like, what some of the things that you see and bring back to your team?
So
because your team probably has, oh, I know this one. I've seen this
sure.
before, and then you go out there and you go, well, maybe it's not exactly
sure.
how you planned.
Well, one of the things that I really credit our chief product officer with is that she's very much committed to making sure that people from all of our teams end up going to do an on-site visit at some point while mm-hmm. they're here.
Oh, so that's part of
that
your
that is
DNA.
Something that is part of our DNA. So everybody from sales to the development team has gone out at some point and has stood in front of our customers to use our products, answer questions, and be accountable if there were things that weren't working well.
Right.
So I think there's a good deal of customer empathy because we've baked that into our team culture. But things that I've seen that were really fun to bring back. So I went out on one inspection and I interviewed two folks. I interviewed someone who was more front of house for an apartment complex, who is a leasing consultant or property manager, something like that. And I asked him, you know, what are your standard operating practices for this particular process? And, you know, he gives me like, this 12-page checklist that they have for inspecting apartments.
Like
and
on paper
me,
checklist?
Yeah, like a paper checklist that he expects his maintenance team to take out into the field and like painstakingly take notes about the state of everything from the hardware to the carpet.
So this industry still uses paper?
Yeah. It's slowly moving toward technology, but mm-hmm. it's a huge opportunity. The technology that's there, some of it's not serving its customers well.
Right.
So we want to tackle that. But I talked to the property manager about this, and then I go out and I talk to the maintenance guy.
The person who actually has to do
the inspection. And I'm like, you know, tell me about how you get this done. And he's like, well, you know, most of my team doesn't speak English, so there's that. This 12-page
checklist is
worthless. Right. And, you know, they've got 50 to 60% of any apartment complex's units turn in a year. So it's constant. They're constantly having to do these inspections. So he says, you know what I do? I go in and here's my inspection checklist. And he just shows me this blue painter's tape. And he goes, I go into a unit, I peel off a piece of tape and I put it on every single thing in the apartment that needs to be fixed. And then
without
I send my guys, without instructions, they go in and they do that.
Wherever
and then
the tape is,
back.
They got to figure out whatever he thought the problem was.
Exactly. And then I come back and I do a quality inspection. And then I'll go back and I only fill out the things where there is substantive damage, right? Like, we do not have time to go through this. And which, of course, horrified the property manager, right?
Right. His head exploded.
Right. But the thing is that those workarounds that you see, like with the blue painter's tape, that's actually really genius.
Right.
So you
he
take
solved
that,
the problem.
Exactly. Well, it works for a reason.
He could work for Tim.
So
I'm nodding my head over here.
So, you know, I take those insights back and then we talk about new possibilities, new design possibilities for how our software can better.
But do you bring those two in a room together and say, look, let's try to.
No, God, no.
No.
So no, that... not my job is not to get anyone in trouble with their superiors. But no, my job is to be an observer, you know. People who do my work often come from a social sciences background. So there's a lot of the same research techniques that are used in UX to go out and observe the human factors in dealing with technology.
But you have to understand what the person wants, how it's being done now, mm-hmm. and then kind of find a bridge that's sure. going to satisfy both of them.
Sure. The funny thing is most people don't know what they want, and that's actually until not a good after, thing to solve for.
They know what they don't want when they see it.
They know what they don't they know what they don't want. They know what's going wrong. And that's actually a more interesting thing to think about. What's going wrong? What workarounds have they created to address that issue? And what are they actually trying to achieve, which is not necessarily the same thing that they want out of right. a piece of software. And then designing from there. So
now that you create the software for them, so you're taking existing software and you're tweaking it to their individual needs?
Yeah. So Info Tycoon's got an interesting story. We're 7 years old and our product team has all been here for less than a year. We are completely new product folks. And essentially we've had a legacy app that mm-hmm. has worked really well. But our business has essentially doubled in the last year. And so we're at the point where we needed to scale. So we're essentially today launching our new app, which has one of our main modules. So my team downstairs is feverishly testing, making sure to kick the tires and making sure that it's performing well. But we've been working to sustain the legacy product while building an entirely new app.
And so that's like it's not just a tweaked
No,
this
not
is
at
a,
all.
Kind of a reboot.
It's a complete reboot. So there are still some of our modules that will live on the legacy product for a while right. we're building it out. But for our first and main module, that's being released live with a client today. So that's really exciting. We've been working for months on this. And
I would have loved to be a fly on the wall when you were discussing, hey, let's just everything we did before all those years, let's get rid of and do this new thing.
Yeah.
How'd that conversation go?
Oh, man. Well, I mean, I think, you know, people knew what some of the legacy issues were before they hired the new product team.
Right.
But that's been my entire job has been to go out and actually do testing with our clients, extensive interviews with our clients.
Because you had happy clients.
We did. We have happy clients.
Right.
They've been with us since the beginning. But, you know... We definitely noticed some performance issues as right. we were scaling up, and it was time to just build a new platform entirely. Right. So,
and then was that a hard conversation with the existing clients to kind of?
Oh, sure. It's a very intricate process, you know. I mean, you're basically having to maintain this thing and slowly migrate folks over
right.
in bits and pieces to the new product, and that comes with a host of challenges, right? But I think. Part of what has made that successful so far is that, you know, the multifamily industry in general is very much built around relationships. We have close relationships with our customers. I try to talk to a customer at least one per week on the phone. I'm often in the field every other week if I can to see folks in their native environments. But they've been with us. I think one of the things that's made that successful is that we've brought them in to be a part
of the solution.
Of the solution to have them come in and think about co-designing certain
right.
aspects of it or certain
so
interactions.
So they have some pride of authorship.
They do. They have pride of authorship, and then we follow up with them so they know that we really do care about their feedback. You know.
And then, so now it's being released right now as we speak.
It kind is. Of. So we have got a client who's doing an inspection today mm-hmm. in Texas and with our new product. So like I said, for the last 48 hours, we've been working around the clock to test it, to try to find every single possible error that could happen and solve for that. But it's going really well so far.
Great.
So,
and then how long do you think it'll take to kind of integrate it and make this full transition?
Well, I think for this full module, at least, we're ready to go, you know. We'll be making some small changes to that throughout the course of Q1 and Q2. And then in terms of our next modules, I think probably Q3, we're going to start building in for the next one. So we're doing it in phases based on the demand and the use of the modules that are currently active with our customers.
And you have clients all over the U.S.?
We do, all over the U.S. We have a couple of clients internationally as well. Mm-hmm. So we are thinking about geolocality, right? Like we have a client who wants to expand into the China market. And so we're thinking about how do you take an inspection template or any of the other things that we've built and translate that in a way that feels organic and makes right. sense linguistically.
In whatever culture
you got
you're
it.
In.
You got it.
And so what do you need more of right now? Same thing with Tim.
Also
more
time. We also need time always. Yeah.
So now why did you guys locate in WeWork?
You know,
because you've been around for a while. You've been around pre WeWork, right?
Previously, we had an office in Roswell. Before I joined the team, we had
a standalone office.
They
right?
did. They had a more traditional, cube style office in Roswell. And as the company got a reboot,
needed a fresh start.
Just got a fresh start. Mm-hmm. You know, our executive chairman, KP Reddy, founder of Shadow Ventures, basically, came in and
said, I'm moving my office here.
Moving.
So everybody's
coming with
me.
We're going to inject new blood into this company. Mm-hmm. We're going to change the culture of this company.
Right.
And I think moving here was a huge part of that. There is something really exciting about being co-located with people who are doing really interesting things,
right.
There's also the proximity to Atlanta Tech Village, which is useful, I think, mm-hmm. for our purposes. So.
And you never know who you'll run into.
You really
might
don't.
Run into somebody from your high school.
Exactly.
It's weird, right?
On the same radio show.
What are the odds of that? So. Those collisions, they can happen anywhere, anytime.
Exactly.
So if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the pain they're having? What is this apartment complex or having right now where you're the right call to make? Are they frustrated by the, turnaround time or their...
Yeah. So to give a little context for a due diligence inspection, most of these are done when a management company or an individual buyer wants to purchase a property or a series of properties. Mm-hmm. So the management company may have 2 or 3 days to go in and inspect every single unit and to inspect every single file, a lease file.
That's a lot of pages to flip
it's
through if
huge,
they got paper.
It's a huge liability, right? So they've got this really contracted time period to go out and do their due diligence and then turn around and create reports that talk about the financial mm-hmm. and the physical health of that property.
But if they had Info Tycoon, they could easily see everything would be digital,
we
right?
We can easily get that information compiled and cranked for them.
Good stuff. Well, again, the website?
Infotycoon.com.
Well, thank you so much, Christine, for sharing your story.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hang with us. We've got one more guest, the headliner. The moment we've been waiting for, J.R. McNair with the Container Box. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So did you learn anything other than your high school buddy is working around the corner from you?
I know. That was so great running into her. And, I mean, we got to catch up after this. And, I mean, no, the both of their companies are outstanding. I think they solve real problems. And I think that's what's great.
Now, tell us about the Container Box. What problem are you solving?
Well, there's a global housing crisis. I don't know if you know about it, but
I've heard rumors to that effect.
Yeah. So, in a funny thing, I think a lot of people don't realize it's not just for people that are in lower income brackets, but mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about housing crisis for the working class, for the even the middle class and upper middle class. I mean, most people that are around our age group in as far as what we consider millennials, even in baby boomers, they most of them don't even own homes. I mean, 60%+ of them don't own homes. And I think that's because of the fact that good housing is not affordable right now.
So you think that that's not a choice for a more flexible lifestyle that they I thought young people want to be able to pick up and go wherever they want, whenever they want.
I think that's part of it. And I think you have a certain group that. Yeah, definitely. But if the whole point of being able to pick up and go is not having 60% of your income go to your living expenses, 50-60%. So, I mean, I think this is with anybody, they want to have a home base, but just being able to have the flexibility to say, you know what? I don't have all these expenses, so I can go on a trip to Italy, or I can go somewhere and don't worry about how much money I'm spending on a meal because I don't have to save every single dollar just to live.
Mm-hmm. So now what's the container box solution?
Well, the container box, see, this is the thing. I think this is a complicated issue when you talk about housing and how it's crafted, because, you know, there are housing that's being produced, but, you know, the housing that's being produced is on the upper end of housing. So you have a certain high echelon housing that's being produced. And we're not trying to produce housing for the poor. We're trying to produce housing for, I would say, right in that middle area there, just to make housing affordable for them all. So what we do, predominantly most of your cost goes in housing and of course the construction, and that goes on site, finding the right kind of staffing people to be there, people that have the right skill sets to be able to produce these things. And what we've seen, I became a materials provider, actually a distributor for a company back in like 2006 in Kannapolis, North Carolina. And they would send these different, they would call it open panel construction, these different panels, like a wall one, wall two, wall three, and they would send them like in all these different puzzle pieces on an 18-wheeler to a site. And I did that for a while learning some things, and I said the bulk of your expenses come from on-site construction, having to do stuff on site, having to hire people on site. You're dealing with rain and the elements that can take into that factor. So what we said is, let's try to produce as much as we can offsite. Okay, we're producing them in factories. We're producing them where they where we can see. See, a lot of times when you traditionally build things, when they're stick built, there's a lot of human error, you know, because we're dealing with humans, right?
Because people have to measure. They can be off by little.
That's correct. And so a lot of people say, well, if I'm dealing on site, it's going to be a better product. Not necessarily, and in most cases, not.
Right.
Because they have that human error. But we're able to produce it the right way, make sure we have our measurements tight inside of a factory, and then send it. That's actually the bulk of how most things today are actually produced in some capacity.
Manufacturing, that's how it's done.
They're manufacturing. So what we do is we take, right now, our first product that we got, just because it's the easiest for us to get into the market, is we take shipping containers. And we convert them into homes. Y'all have probably seen the show on HGTV, Container Homes, right? Where they take shipping containers and they turn them in some fabulous modern architecture. I mean, they're phenomenal. But we take them, we insulate them, put all the electrical, put everything in there, and then we, in certain of our units, they're smarter units that we have, we end up producing, getting things done, but we get them, we ship them out to them. They can either have it bolted right on site, have it mobile, however they choose to do it, but it's all there for one set price. And a lot of times people can pay these off in 5 years or less, sometimes 5 to 10 years, depending on how they want to do the finance.
So they buy the land. So they're responsible for the land. And then do they put that foundational base of cement in, and then you bolt the container to it?
That is correct. So we can do a couple ways. So with some of the units that we build, we can put them on, if they want to have them mobile, we can do that for them. Most of the units, yeah, they need to have land. We do have a great network of land that's available. And that's the thing, you know, although there might not be as much housing, there is a lot of land. And so you can find a lot of land in various pockets and put these there.
How much land do you need?
You don't need a lot of land. I mean, you're talking about our base unit is 40 by 8. So that's like 320 square feet in a foundation.
How many containers is that?
That's one container.
That's one shipping container?
That is one container. And so we have a smaller one that a lot of people will use for like what we call accessory dwelling units. Mm-hmm. These are ADUs that can go, that have a separate kitchen, all those things like that.
And that's built into the box?
That everything's built into the box. It comes with the bedroom, kitchen, bathroom. I mean, everything. It's all inclusive.
And it doesn't look like a box.
Not at all. As a matter of fact, I can show you a picture.
On the website is thecontainerbox.com, so you can see pictures to see what this thing looks like.
Totally. And you'll be surprised. I mean, it looks like something that you would pay an architect, $20,000 just to design.
But like, say I have a house now, mm-hmm. but on my backyard, I can throw one of these things and
totally.
Do a rental unit?
That, you know, a lot of people do that. And so they can take these, and these are what I call, I said, ADUs or accessory dwelling units, which pretty much means it's an apartment on site
right.
that has an entrance, a kitchen, a bathroom. And people can do these, some people call them granny pods for people that are elderly. They will have them, some in-law suites, they'll have them. I mean, it's a lot of different uses for your kids who may need to save some money and put it on the back of their house on that end. And, you know, I mean, we actually have in a lot of our units, solar power generators that end up, you don't even have to hook up power to it. It's
because
automatic.
It's so small. It doesn't take a lot to heat and air condition it.
Not at all. And so, I mean, we made these things to where they would be very sustainable to the point to where you can, it doesn't take that much to get them cooled. It doesn't take that much to heat them up. And we have in a lot of our units, we have a lot of windows, okay, for natural sunlight to come right. in and various things like that.
So now, are they out in the wild? Are people living in them right now? Yeah, well, what stage are you at in the business?
Well, we just launched actually this month. And
this
so
month.
This month we...
So you're the only one living in one?
Oh, well, right now, like I said, we're actually developing one to go on display in downtown Atlanta. It'll be in display next month, so mm-hmm. you'll be able to go and see it.
So now, is this something I read about a while ago, that in Texas there's a kind of a tiny house area for the homeless people mm-hmm. to give them their own home? Is this something that could work in that kind of environment as well?
Totally. We have other units that we specifically, they don't have all the thrills and spills right. that this one has, that where they're toned down just for the homeless. Because, yeah, I mean, we're looking at a problem right now. We don't know where and how to be able to solve that. And so, yeah, this can definitely solve it. We're actually working with a couple of organizations right now that want to have us help them to build some units for homeless people, and sometimes transitional, so that they can get off of the streets, get into
their
place,
own place that's theirs, that
work.
Nobody messes with them. They work, they can use it and sleep there.
Totally, totally. So this is a viable solution for not later, but right now.
Right, because this, you don't need that much land to probably put 50, 100 of these things.
Not at all.
In kind of a mini neighborhood.
Not at all, especially if you stack them.
Right.
I mean, if you stack them, you can get even more than that.
What's the highest you can stack of these?
Well, you know, that all depends on the code of the area.
In Tornado Alley, probably less.
But I'm gonna tell you what. I mean, these things weigh a lot. So you got to realize the ship containers are put on big vessels
and ships
across the world, and so they're stacking these things already like so many high in the sky. So I mean, they weigh so much. It would take more to pull this off the ground than it would your house by two or three. I promise you that.
So now, the way it works is I go to your website, I kind of customize my own house,
yes.
my own container, and then you bring it to my spot and bolt it down, and then I'm ready to go?
Yes. And we can do it in a lot of different fashions. One of our first thing that we do is just we sit down and we just kind of talk via phone or we're talking to really get what are you trying to accomplish.
Right.
And then we'll let you know. Some cases we'll put several of these together, and where some of the stuff is done off site, but some of it's done on site, depending on how big. I mean, we can go up to 5,000-6,000 square feet if they chose to.
Right.
Right. But
that's the beauty of it. It flexes to whatever your needs are.
It flexes to whatever. You're exactly right.
So now, you mentioned just launched. So what do you need right now?
Well, right now what I'm looking for is somebody who we want to get somebody to head up our production here, because currently we're outsourcing some of our production. And so we have a part in-house production. Mm-hmm. But we want to find somebody here because we're getting ready to open up a big manufacturing plant. And so we need
Where
somebody.
Where is that going to be?
It's going to be in Atlanta. We're still trying to finalize a specific location.
Right. So you're looking for talent as head of production?
We're looking for a head of production. We're looking.
I know a guy that's good with people.
Okay, that's right. And on the technical side, we have some technology that we've developed that really makes this very technology driven. We have a smart box where it's fully integrated smart house, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really cool. So we're looking for a CTO on that end also. And also for distributors.
Like who would be a good distributor for you?
Somebody that either has land already or either has access to land, and somebody who has a good network knows how to market. So they would pretty much be going and distributing and getting our products out there.
So you want them anywhere in the country, right?
Anywhere in the country, yes. We'll take them any and everywhere.
And then you're going to start out here in Atlanta to start. This is because you're here, but then this can be anywhere, obviously.
It can be anywhere. As a matter of fact, I have a lot of contacts in Germany, Hamburg, Germany. I used to play professional football over mm-hmm. there in Hamburg. So we have people all throughout Germany, Austria, Denmark.
Because they have the same issues. Housing is a problem everywhere.
Oh, listen, the number one place typically that has a problem with housing right now is London. And so you're looking at a lot of that stuff. They're finding creative ways to make things happen. But I think that they're still in the phase of trying to figure it all out.
Mm-hmm. And then if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the best way to learn more about what you got going on?
Go to Container Box, thecontainerbox.com. But you can also reach out to me through Facebook, facebook.com/JR McNair, or through LinkedIn, or through Twitter. Any way, you can reach out directly to my personal email at info@JRMcNair.com.
And then this is a person, they might want their own container to live in because it's so much more affordable than traditional housing, or if they're a distributor and wants to sell this and kind of learn the business opportunity, they can go and reach out to you.
They can definitely do that. And I'll actually be looking forward to hearing from them.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing the story. And again, that website is thecontainerbox.com. Thank you, JR.
Thank you so much.
All right. That's a wrap. This is Lee Cantor. We will see you all next time on WeWork Radio.